This is a CBC podcast. CBC News is your source for breaking news from Canada and around the world. Get the latest in health, the arts, technology, and business at cbcnews.ca.
Hello, I'm Helen Mann, sitting in for Carol Off.
Good evening. I'm Chris Howden, sitting in for Barbara Budd. This is, as it happens, the podcast edition. Tonight,
Tundra struck. When the federal government cuts their funding, Canadian global warming researchers in the Arctic see their hopes melt away.
Serial killer. We thought the deadly wheat disease stem rust had been eradicated, but it's stalking the world once again.
He's only a tree hugger because there are no other options. Scientists in California follow the lonely exploits of a male wolverine who lives hundreds of miles from any potential mate.
And they were uptight, but now everything's all right. In 1981, the French government gave Stevie Wonder a prestigious cultural award, which he finally stopped by Paris to pick up last Saturday. As it happens, the podcast edition, radio that assumes France spent 29 years wondering, will wonder never stop? Call it a sudden deep freeze. This week, the Harper government announced that it will no longer fund the Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Sciences. The decision was part of last week's budget, which, among other things, included a significant freeze in public spending. The Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Sciences is the main funding body for Canadian researchers studying climate change, and so the cuts have cast a chilling pall across the research community. James Drummond heads the Polar Environment Atmospheric Research Laboratory, or PEARL, on Ellesmere Island. We reached him in Toronto.
Dr. Drummond, first of all, how did you learn that the funding for the Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Sciences was not going to be renewed?
Well, this has been an ongoing discussion in the community for probably about the last 18 months that the foundation has come to the end of its current tranche of funding, and you know, the question of renewal has been broached several times. And so, you know, actively we've been discussing this for period of about 18 months, but it, as time goes on, of course, it becomes more critical as we come right to the end of the funding and as projects start to wind up and there's nothing to replace them.
What does that mean then in terms of this PEARL lab on Ellesmere Island? Does it close?
Yes, it will undoubtedly close unless new funding is available within you know, a 12-month period.
What kind of work is done at the lab?
The lab measures the atmosphere at a location which is very, very far north. If you look it up on a map, it's halfway up Ellesmere Island. And we do studies that are related to air quality in the Arctic and how that develops and how that might change. We do measurements in support of ozone studies and how the ozone layer is doing. And we also do measurements in support of climate change studies. And we do those measurements throughout the year, even in the winter months, which is tough but very necessary if you're to get a very good picture of what's happening over the entire year.
So you provide this data. Do you also produce analysis?
Yes, we data is no good really unless it's analyzed. And so we have scientists who do the analysis and publish the papers in the scientific journals and conferences, and also a fair amount of data goes out on the web.
How significant a portion of Canadian climate change research, then, does this comprise, the work that is done at this lab?
It's hard to say in percentage terms, a substantial piece of it. It's certainly not the only piece. I mean, the atmospheric research is not just done in the Arctic, it's done right across Canada. And, you know, the Foundation's support has been important for that research in the whole various areas of endeavor, not just climate change, but issues of droughts and ocean fisheries and carbon cycle and things like that. Lots of areas where the Foundation has supported research and we've been moving forward.
Mm. The Environment Minister, Jim Prentice, says that this is really a good time to assess the work of the Foundation before making any decisions, I guess, on continuing funding. Do you think that that's a good point?
Well, I think it's a good point, except that the Foundation has produced annual reports every year. It's produced two interim evaluations of its activities, and it's 1 to 2 months away from providing a third external evaluation of its activities. So, I think its evaluation has been an ongoing part of the whole operation, and adding to that, all the research is peer-reviewed and competitively awarded. So there has been a fair amount of ongoing evaluation. I don't know that starting a new evaluation cycle at this point is a positive thing to do.
So as far as you're concerned, the Foundation's met its objectives?
I believe it has, yes.
Minister Prentice also says that the government remains committed to basic research on climate change and that it has other avenues perhaps to pick up some of the work that's been done by the Pearl Lab. What do you say to that?
I'd be very interested to know what those avenues were. We feel we're in the position at the moment where we could write a very good proposal, and all our proposals are written to be competed. We're not in the business of obtaining funding by right. We compete for our funding. We'd be happy to write a competitive proposal, but we don't believe that within Canada there's a program extant that we could send that proposal to at this time.
How committed do you think the Harper government is to basic climate research based on what you're seeing?
I've no idea of what the what the internal operations of the government are. I mean, politics is a very complicated business, and so, quite honestly, I prefer to stick and do my science. But the science does have a public good about it. It's not science that's going to make any company a huge profit. You don't make profit out of studying the atmosphere in the high Arctic. But it is something that I think is important to every Canadian, and so it's something that's public good, and in 5 and 10 and 15 and 20 years' time, people are going to be building on what we've done. And if we don't do it, then there's just going to be a big hole in the data that can never be filled in.
Do you expect that there are defenders out there who will fight to see some level of restoration of funding either from the government or, I guess, potentially some other source?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, we would certainly like to see funding. We're not committed to any particular form of funding. The research is the objective that we have in mind. It's the difficulty right now, as I mentioned earlier, is that we don't really see an avenue to obtain the continuing funding that's necessary to keep the people employed. And these are the scientists that we're going to rely on in the future for all our subsequent knowledge.
Dr. Drummond, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
All right, goodbye.
Bye.
James Drummond is the lead investigator with the Polar Environment Atmospheric Research Laboratory on Ellesmere Island and a professor of physics at Dalhousie University. We reached him in Toronto. It's called the polio of agriculture, and like the deadly human disease, there was a time when stem rust, a deadly spore that wipes out entire crops of wheat, was believed to have been eradicated, thanks to wheat hybridization. But now the pathogen, known formally as Puccinia graminis, has returned, starting in Uganda and spreading out across the world. And if this strain, known as UG99, reaches the breadbaskets of South Asia and North America, it could cause a global food crisis on an almost unimaginable scale. So it's a good thing Les Sabo has been studying the spore for more than 20 years. He's a research geneticist at the Cereal Disease Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Agriculture in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Dr. Sabo, just how dangerous is this new strain of stem rust called UG99?
It has the potential to eliminate 80% of the world wheat crop and cause severe famine in certain parts of the world, especially if it gets into the Punjab area in India and Pakistan.
That's pretty terrifying. You say potential. How strong is that potential?
Well, it all depends on how fast it moves and how soon resistant varieties can be generated and deployed.
Tell me what we've learned historically. This was a problem back up till, I guess, the 1950s. How much of a problem was it at that point?
Historically, wheat stem rust is the most devastating wheat of pathogen of wheat or disease of wheat. And there are records going back to biblical times of mass devastation of cereal crops due to stem rust. In North America, the last big epidemic was in the early 1950s, where 40% of the wheat crop in Minnesota and the Dakotas were wiped out.
So how was this stem rust stopped back in the 50s?
The way it was stopped was through breeding varieties that had multiple layers of resistance.
What's happened since then?
A couple things happened. One is that germplasm base was very successful. It had a number of layers of resistance to stem rust, and therefore stem rust essentially dropped off everybody's radar. And over time, those layers of resistance broke down, and so there was only one resistance gene left, and that was called SR31. And that was stable for quite a while, and people kept thinking, well, that's going to be stable, we don't need to be concerned about. And that's why UG99 is a highly virulent race that was first found in Uganda and characterized in 1999. It overcomes this last layer of defense.
How easily can this spore travel?
The Uridinia spores, or the spores that spread this disease, are easily airborne. And so here in North America, the wheat stem rust pathogen survives down around the Gulf Coast. And on spring and early summer winds, it's carried from the Gulf Coast up into central North America and actually all the way up into the prairie provinces of Canada.
So if it reached that area, what scale of devastation are we talking about?
UG99 comes into the U.S. in the current situation. We're looking at, again, in the range of 80% of the wheat and barley that's grown in the U.S. will be susceptible.
How far and how quickly has this UG99 spread at this point?
So after its first discovery and characterization in 99, it then was found in Kenya a few years later, and then has spread to Ethiopia, Yemen, and most recently it was found in 2007 in Iran. And that's the big concern, because it's made that jump into Central Asia. And the expectation now is, since it's in Iran, it's only a matter of time before it gets into the large wheat-growing areas in Central Asia and Pakistan and India.
This is a huge potential for famine, as you've pointed out.
That's correct.
What is being done to try and stop it?
So there is a large international effort called the Global Rust Initiative to work on this, looking at breeding, looking at all sorts of aspects. And there's been funding put in by governments and Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Hmm. Is it difficult to convince farmers to change their wheat varietal?
Yes, it is. If there's no disease pressure, if they don't see their field or their neighbor's field being taken out by this pathogen, then it's going to be difficult to convince them that they need to change unless there's other advantages, such that better quality, better yield. So yeah, that is going to be a big challenge. It's also many of different types of wheats, and so you have to get it into the different types of wheat that's adapted for the different usage and the different climates around the world. And then you have to increase it, and that's a huge undertaking.
How optimistic are you that you'll be able to stop this before it becomes a major crisis?
Well, we hope we can do it. But it all depends on how fast it moves.
Just in terms of the science, how much progress have you made?
Well, there's been a massive effort in terms of screening germplasm and identifying resistance. And there are a number of good resistant genes that's been identified and look like they will work. The important thing to keep in mind is that you can't just put out one resistant gene. You have to put out a package, because after the epidemics, in 2004 or 5 in Kenya. They changed varieties and put out a new variety of wheat with a single resistant gene, and it just took a year before that one broke down. And so they switched the wheat again, and it took another year, and that one broke down. So it's going to be a challenge. But there are a number of genes that look like they're effective, and it's a race to put the package together.
Dr. Szabo, thank you for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure.
All right, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Les Szabo is a research geneticist at the Cereal Disease Laboratory of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He was in St. Paul, Minnesota. Today, American activist Rachel Corrie's family is in Haifa, where they want to put a matter to rest in an Israeli court. The family is launching a civil suit against the Israeli military over the death of Ms. Corrie 7 years ago. On March 16, 2003, Rachel Corrie was killed in Gaza while she was trying to stop Israeli military bulldozers from leveling homes. She was crushed by one of those bulldozers. The day after Ms. Corrie's death, As It Happens interviewed an activist who witnessed the event. Former host Mary Lou Finley spoke with Will Hewitt. Here's part of that interview from March 17, 2003.
Several times people sat down in front of bulldozers and they came right up, you know, pushing earth and kind of rubble in front of them to where the people were sitting and stopped. And Rachel was in front of one bulldozer at a little distance from the rest of the people. And she'd been there for at least 10 minutes in the area of that bulldozer, standing in front of it and, you know, gesturing and... it's difficult to hear people's voices without a megaphone when you're inside of the bulldozers because, you know, the armor plated and thick glass windows and thick windows and so on. But, you know, she was clearly visible and she was gesturing and she was speaking and she was wearing a bright orange fluorescent coat with reflective tape on it. And then behind her was the house of a Palestinian doctor, which she had slept at before, to protect the house. And she sat down, began to sit down on the ground. The bulldozer, after approaching, you know, pushing, like, the turning mound of dirt in front of it, and she was sitting on the ground, and she started to get up and try to kind of scoot backwards and move away, and it kept coming and kept coming. And she eventually was able to stand up, but got kind of caught in the dirt in front of the blade of the bulldozer and fell, and her foot, I guess, her feet got caught under the blade, and the driver just kept driving over her completely.
Do you think he could see her at that point?
It's impossible for the driver to not know that she was there. I mean, she was directly in front of the bulldozer for quite some time before she sat down, and the driver must have seen her sit down.
From our archives, that was former As It Happens host Mary Lou Finley speaking with activist Will Hewitt about the death of Rachel Corrie. The Israeli military denies any responsibility in the activist's death and maintains that the driver of the bulldozer wasn't aware she was there. The Corrie family's civil lawsuit starts today. As far as animal videos go, it's not as exciting as, say, footage of Bigfoot or Ogopogo. But the video of a lone wolverine in California is still creating a sensation on the West Coast. The wolverine is named Buddy. And what's exciting about the video is that it comes about 90 years after the wolverine supposedly went extinct in California. A male wolverine was first spotted in the region a couple of years ago. And now, genetic testing of hair samples has confirmed that that male wolverine was Buddy too, and that he is not a descendant of the last known wolverine population in California. Amanda Shuffelberger is a wildlife biologist in Grass Valley, California.
Amanda, how did this Buddy the wolverine end up in California?
Well, that's part of the big mystery, is everyone has their different theories. From DNA, we know he came from the Sawtooth Mountains of Idaho. So how he got here, we don't know. So some of the theories are that he had help from humans, either accidental or intentional. Another theory is that he walked here himself, which is quite a distance.
How far?
That would be, well, for him, as the crow flies, it's, I think, only about less than 500 miles. But the route that he would have taken probably through a lot of the mountain ranges would have been almost 1,000 miles.
And pretty treacherous, I can imagine.
Yeah, and going through a lot of kind of non-typical wolverine habitat, some of the high-elevation desert. They're usually high-elevational species above tree line.
So do you doubt the theory that he came there himself?
So I try to keep an open mind. Another theory is that maybe his heritage says he's from Idaho, but maybe he's just a remnant from a population that's just been hiding out and that's gone undetected since then. And then all of a sudden he pops up in 2008. So maybe, you know, they are really reclusive mammals. So possibly they've just been hiding out this whole time.
But 90 years is a long time to be hiding out with no sightings. No?
It is. It is. It's fun and it's frustrating in the science community just because we don't have the answers. But then when you get people all together, everyone kind of has their different theories. And I don't know, what about this? Or what if he hopped a train? You know, like everyone kind of just throws out their ideas. Anything's possible. They're all equally plausible and unlikely at the same time.
And you mentioned the DNA testing that, mm-hmm. that allowed you to discover this Idaho strain. How did you get the sample for the testing?
We started a forest carnivore camera study, and we were just moving up the Sierra Nevadas, and it was in North Tahoe area where he all of a sudden just showed up at one of these bait stations with a motion sensor camera. And mm-hmm. so what we do is put gun cleaning bristles, actually, attached to the tree, and then when he reaches up to try to eat the food, he rubs usually his belly on those bristles, and it will snag some of the hair out. So then we send that hair to a lab, and they do the testing.
Now, you say he was first spotted in 2008. How often are you seeing him?
I have almost 1,000 pictures of him over the last two winters, pictures and video. I had, at one time, like 20 different camera stations usually about a mile apart from each other. And he had a route where he just would hit one after another after another. So I see him quite often, not in person, but through the lens, I see him quite often.
Now, spring is coming. Animals mm-hmm. are looking for mates. Buddy yes. is alone. It sounds
yes.
awful.
Yeah, wolverines are solitary creatures, but yes, they will start looking for a female to mate up with starting around this time. But he hasn't the last two winters. He's stayed with us in the same area. So far, he's kind of, I just call him the consummate bachelor. He hasn't left us. He's choosing food over the alternative, I guess.
Well, if the alternative is hiking back over the Sierras, I can kind of understand where he's coming from.
Yeah, definitely.
Any
getting fed. Yeah.
Any temptation to trap him and return him to where there is a wolverine population?
No, he is listed as threatened by the state of California, and he's a fully protected species. So pretty much it's hands off.
Mm-hmm. Now, how have people reacted to seeing this, I guess? Because, I mean, there's obviously a concern when a species is wiped out. Were they thrilled that he showed up?
Absolutely thrilled. I have been astonished by the reaction. I kind of am the sounding board now for people for wolverine sightings since 1960. You know, everyone's, oh, I've seen one. And I don't doubt it at all. There's just not proof of it. But everyone is just so excited and has their own story about him and trying to, you know, they want to get a glimpse and they want to bring him a girlfriend. I mean, everyone's like so concerned about him. So it really has been a great reaction.
You sound as if you have some affection towards Buddy.
I try not to, but he just makes my job so much fun. It's a lot of work to get out there, snowmobile or cross-country skis or sometimes snowshoeing out there with chicken or deer carcass on my back. And when I get to a station and can tell when he's there, I must say, I am pretty excited.
Well, it is a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Helen.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Amanda Shuffelberger spoke to us from Grass Valley, California. On the menu at the parliamentary cafeteria in Ottawa today, seal meat with a side of politics. Liberal Senator Céline Hervieux-Payette invited her colleagues to a nonpartisan lunch featuring double-smoked, bacon-wrapped seal loin in a port reduction. The event was meant to demonstrate that support for Canada's seal hunt on the Hill is near unanimous. It's not actually unanimous because of one of the senator's own caucus members. Liberal Senator Mac Harb opposes the seal hunt. We reached him in Ottawa.
Senator Harb, what did you have for lunch today?
I had fish.
And where did you eat it?
At the parliamentary restaurant, and I walked by the room where a few politicians, including the minister of Fishery and Ocean, locked themselves up, supposedly eating seal meat. But I was told that there wasn't really much of seal meat there. It was totally covered with bacon and sauce.
Now, you say you walked by and they were locked in. I know you had intended to actually take a peek to see what was going on. Weren't you allowed in?
I did. I took a peek and I saw who was there. Quite a few people from the government side and the opposition side.
Did they seem to be enjoying their meal?
Not much, really. From the look on their faces, it looked like almost like some of them went in there kicking and screaming.
And what did it smell like and what did it look like from your point
really
of view?
It smelled really fishy and doesn't really look good. I mean, from the look of it, it all amounts to a political game. It's a lip service to an issue that deserves very serious attention and serious action.
Senator Hervieux-Payette, who organized this luncheon, says that you are the only dissenting voice in Parliament that is opposed to this seal hunt. Is that true?
Not really. There are a lot of members of Parliament, as well as senators, who privately come to me on a regular basis to tell me that they support what I'm doing. But given the political system and the way it works, they don't have, the ability to speak out because of the party system that exists here. And yesterday, for the first time ever, I was able to have a seconder for the bill that I introduced in the Senate. And the person who seconded that bill is Lowell Murray, who's a veteran politician, progressive conservative. But what unfortunately happened, the organized political parties decided to shut me down and not allow the debate on it.
As I understand it, though, Senator Murray didn't necessarily say he supported your motion, more that he supported your right to open it to discussion.
Precisely, and never in the history of Parliament we ever had a serious debate about this issue. In fact, the government have decided to shut down debate.
Now, is your bill in favor of a complete ban?
Complete ban on commercial seal hunt, but there's an exemption for Aboriginals. Individuals who go out in order to hunt like three or four seals in order to support their families, they will not be impacted by this. This is geared directly toward commercial seal hunt.
But those who support the seal fishery argue that this produces millions of dollars in exports for people who live in remote communities. Why don't you support them? Why defend the seals?
Well, the truth is that the government is propagating propaganda. It's nothing more than that. It's not millions. It used to be millions, but the market really have gone down to the tune of last year. The take-home of sealers not more than $1 million totally for 6,000 sealers, supposedly. And that's really not much of a take-home. If you look at the amount of money that the government spent on subsidizing the industries, on fashion shows that the minister traveled to, on ambassadors, on challenge to the World Trade Organizations, all those monies will be better spent if they were to support the sealers in transitional programs to help them to enter into a proper industry that can be viable. This industry is not viable. The second problem I have with the government is that they keep telling people that the sealers use every part of the seal. It's totally untrue. Last year, I personally went as a witness to the seal hunt, and I saw a hundred of bodies being left on the ice, skinned, and left for what?
So what is your rationale? Why do you oppose the hunt?
First, the majority of Canadians don't want it. Second, the international community, our major trading partners, the United States, as well as Europe and other countries, have told us no. They feel offended. They don't want to see the product on their shelves. And third is the fact that this is a species that at some point in time it's going to be endangered.
Seals are not endangered now. As a matter of fact, they seem to be thriving despite climate change numbers.
Let me tell you, this year, for example, we had a scientist indicating that many of the seals this year will abort their babies in the water, and therefore they will die. That will be thousands of baby seals that will not be able to survive. if the weather continues the way it is now, in no time we will see a depletion of the stock, and we will see ourselves in a situation not very different than we saw during the days when the cod stock was depleted.
Isn't it possible, though, that some people, some parliamentarians, are so defending the right to hunt seals just because the Europeans are telling us not to?
No, this have been going on for quite some time. There is a political posturing by the organized political parties. Frankly, they see it as an opportunity to defend and increase their popularities in certain parts of the countries. When the truth of the matter, they should be standing up and telling the sealers, look, sorry. I mean, this has have to come to an end. And this is how we will transition you out of this industry.
And yet, you know, we're seeing these very public displays from people like the Governor General, for example, of course, who raised so much controversy last year by eating raw seal meat. And I read, you know, in the Globe this week, the seal is chic in Ottawa. You know, given all of that, do you think you realistically have a chance of bringing an end to the hunt?
Yes, it will happen. You know, it will happen. I would rather see it happening sooner rather than later. But, you know, time is on my side and on the community side, on the Canadian side.
Do you eat things like foie gras?
You know what? Yes. I am not a vegetarian. I eat meat, and nothing wrong with eating meat.
So this is not about sympathy for these animals?
No. If you kill to eat, I have no problem with that. If you kill because you want to kill for the sake of killing, I have a problem with that. And what we have here is a situation where there's a kill for the fur, and the price of the fur have gone down, so there's no more economics for it. If you want to kill it to eat it, go ahead. Let's talk. But that's not the case, and that's what I have a major problem with.
Senator Harb, it's good to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye.
Mac Harb is a Liberal senator from Ontario. He was in Ottawa. While a lot of Canadian politicians are giving their seal of approval to seal meat, a lot of European politicians have registered stern disapproval. Last year, the European Union voted to ban the importation of seal products. So this year, one Nunavut politician is fighting back and providing what he believes to be a sober second thought. Fred Schell, MLA for South Baffin, is proposing a boycott of all European liquor. His motion will be put to a vote tomorrow. We reached Mr. Schell in Iqaluit.
Mr. Schell, what is it that you hope to achieve with this proposed boycott of European liquor in Nunavut?
Well, basically, I'm trying to get message across to the European Union that we're not very happy about the seal skin ban, because, after all, we are up in the Nunavut, and I'm just calling just in Nunavut, but also in Newfoundland and eastern Canada. People hunt seals, they eat them, they use every part of it. And part of the issue here is they got to sell their seal skins in order to compensate them for the hunt, as any other hunter would. And a lot of the residents in Nunavut, that is basically their income.
Now, when you talk about a boycott of liquor, do you mean all liquor, wine and beer included, or hard spirits?
No, it's everything, and basically what it is, I'm not banning. We're not banning or make it illegal for European liquor to be consumed or have in their possession in Nunavut. All we're doing is, in Nunavut, there's two liquor stores, they're government liquor stores. We're just saying to the people that the government liquor stores will not stock European spirits or wine. If residents want to order it, they can still order it from down south on their own. But this is basically to be symbolic in stating that as a government, we take a stand that we're not happy with the seal skin ban and that we are going to make a stance.
But will you also be encouraging Nunavut residents to support the boycott?
Not only will I be encouraging Nunavut residents, I'll be encouraging everybody in Canada.
Now, how much money are we talking about in terms of the value of European liquor in Nunavut itself?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have the exact figures, but I can guarantee you that if most of the Canadians take a stance, that's a lot of dollars. Up in Nunavut, it's probably not that big of a deal. It's more symbolic than anything. But I'll tell you, if the residents in Newfoundland and eastern Canada do the same thing, that could mean a lot of dollars.
What makes you think this is the most effective way of responding to the ban on the seal trade?
Well, they've tried everything else. We've tried as a government to go there and put our point across, and they went ahead and banned it anyway. I'm not saying that it's going to work, but I think it would get a strong message to them that we're not happy and we're not going to accept it.
We've just heard a number of things from our previous guest about the seal hunt, and he has suggested that this is actually a dying industry, the commercial sealing industry. Also, that the profits are exaggerated. And counter to what you said, he says that for the most part, except in traditional hunts, the bodies of these seals are not consumed. It's all about the fur. How do you respond to that?
I don't believe that, number one. And number two, of course, they always have the issue that they're not killed humanely. They are up here. And the other issue you've got to remember, there's too many seals in the eastern waters over there. And if they don't continue with the seal hunt and be able to sell the seal skin, there's going to be too many seals and there's going to be no more fish. That's part of the problem with the fish stock being reduced in eastern Canada, because there's too many seals there.
Now, the traditional seal hunt is exempted from the European ban, correct?
That is correct. But if you have no market to send it, it doesn't help us.
And you still also have a commercial sealing industry in Nunavut, too. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as commercial. Basically, what it does is the hunters, they sell it to their local HTA, and then the government here in Nunavut ships them off to North Bay to an auction house where they sell the skins. I mean, they're still eating the seal meat, but the thing is, they rely on selling their skins in order to pay the fuel and stuff like any other hunter would elsewhere in order to be able to go get the food. And if they can't sell the seal skins, it's affecting them greatly.
So even though the Europeans do allow the import of these products from the traditional hunt, people aren't buying them?
That is correct.
Mm. Now, have you contacted any European legislators on this?
No, not as of yet, but I know that our government has been talking to them with no avail. I mean, they've tried, and I know that there's a few lawsuits on the way there as far as seeing if it's legal for what they did. But other than that, we haven't. We're going to try to get this point across, and then we'll see what happens.
Now, you're set to introduce this motion in the legislature tomorrow. What kind of support do you think you have?
I think I've got a pretty good feeling. I think I will get the majority supporting it. I've talked to my lot of the MLAs, and they like the idea. And what we're doing is we're not making it a point where it's illegal to anybody that doesn't agree with this here in Nunavut. They can't come back to me and say, well, you know, because of you, I can't get any European liquor. And they can order it from down south legally through a permit.
But that's not so convenient. It's much easier to go to the local store, no?
Well, not really, because we have a strange system here. We have a liquor store here in Iqaluit, but people from Iqaluit can't get it at that liquor store. They got it ordered from Rankin.
Why is that?
I don't know. We're working on that. We're trying to change the Liquor Act because it is silly. The people from Rankin can't get it at their liquor store in Rankin. They got it ordered from Iqaluit or somewhere else.
Hmm. So do you have a sense that the public are willing to give up their Guinness or their French or Italian wine?
I think they're very willing, especially the people that are directly involved in the seal hunt, which would be like Labrador, Newfoundland, and, of course, the majority of people in Nunavut.
Hmm. When are you proposing this boycott will begin?
Well, I'm asking for it right away. Of course, we work on a different system here. A lot of the liquors come up on sea lift, so obviously there's going to be some liquor left in the warehouses. Of course, we're not going to be silly and say you've got to dump the liquor. We're not that silly. They're going to sell whatever they got, but hopefully the government will take this motion seriously and not order any of the spirits until we get this solved on the next sea lift.
Mr. Shell, thanks for telling us about your initiative.
Not a problem.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Fred Shell is the MLA for South Baffin in Nunavut. We reached him in Iqaluit. Her name was Doris Haddock, but to her 8 grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, and her many supporters, she was known as Granny D. Yesterday, the political activist died at her home in Dublin, New Hampshire, at the age of 100. Granny D is best known for walking over 1,600 kilometers across the United States to advocate for campaign finance reform at the age of 89. That walk took her over a year to complete. By the time she wound up her journey on the Capitol steps in Washington, D.C. in March 2000, she was a political celebrity. In 2004, she ran for the U.S. Senate as a Democrat. She didn't win that race, but lived up to the title of her autobiography, You're Never Too Old to Raise a Little Hell. Today, her former opponent, New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg, said, Granny D demonstrated the extraordinary impact that one person can have on the political process. From our archives, here's Doris Granny D. Haddock talking to Mary Lou Finley on As It Happens about her race for the Senate on June 11th, 2004.
Ms. Haddock?
Yes.
Are you sure you're old enough to run for the Senate?
Well, they seem to think I am.
And what was it that prompted you?
Well, they were looking for somebody to replace, and they had to do it by 5:30 the next day, and they had been looking all over the state, and no one was willing to jump in there, and I said, I'll do it, and so I did. I went up to Concord and signed up for the Senate, the first time I've ever tried to be a politician at all.
I guess you got pretty fit there during that cross-country walk. Do you still have lots of that fitness?
Well, it's 4 years later, of course.
Yeah.
But I walk every day, and I keep my own house. Of course, I've been on the road for getting the vote out.
Yeah.
50% of our people in this country vote, and I've been out on a 20,000-mile trip and trying to do something about that.
Do you have any of your family working with you?
Well, I have a daughter who lives in D.C., but I have a son that lives next door to me, and without him, I never would have even walked out of this door. He has supported me all the way, as has Dennis Burke, who helped me write my book, Granny D., You're Never Too Old to Raise a Little Hell.
Well, listen, I wish you well. I hope you have a very satisfying campaign.
Thank you very much. I know it will be fun. I'm going into this joyously, feeling that it will be another adventure.
Yeah.
And I have no reason to believe that I'm not strong enough to do it. I know my own strength, and I think that there is no problem.
From our archives, that was Doris Haddock, or Granny D, speaking to former host Mary Lou Finley on As It Happens in 2004. The political activist has died at the age of 100. If the French government ever hits on you at a party, don't be coy. If you're interested, just agree to meet the French government at a bistro for some pâtisserie and calvados. If you're not, just look the French government in the eye and tell it to take a hike. Because if you're at all unclear about your feelings, the French government will fill your voicemail with pleadings and text Je t'aime to you every 15 minutes forever. Stevie Wonder learned about the French government's tenacity the hard way. In 1981, the French government named Mr. Wonder a commander of the National Order of Arts and Letters. Mr. Wonder expressed his gratitude, but said he was too busy to attend any ceremony at the time. But the French government does not take "not now" for an answer. We can only infer what happened over the intervening years. It's possible that the French government sent Stevie Wonder a billet doux every day, reminding him his award was waiting for him, and that most of those letters were returned unopened. It's also possible that the French government called him weekly to see whether he was ready to receive the award, and that when Mr. Wonder told the French government he was still busy, that the French government said, "Oh, that's cool, whenever," and then hung up and burst into tears. It's not likely, but it's possible. Whatever happened, the French government's persistence finally paid off. On Saturday, after 29 years of scheduling conflicts, Stevie Wonder finally made it to Paris to accept the honor. Mr. Wonder dedicated the award to his late mother and complimented France on its healthcare system. He was gracious, as always, and then he was off to get another award. At the ceremony, French Culture Minister Frédéric Mitterrand told Stevie Wonder, "As citizen, administrator, and culture minister, I just called to say we love you." We don't know how Mr. Wonder responded, but we hope he very politely said, "Thank you. Now, please stop." You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite 137 following The World at 6.
You can also listen to the whole show on the web. Just go to cbc.ca/AIH and follow the links to our online archive. Thanks for listening. I'm Helen Mann.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.